Good morning. We're beginning our live broadcast day on Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 on the FM dial, strictly against the wishes of the Federal Communications Commission, and streaming live at freakradio.org. That's www.freakradio.org. This is local pirate grassroots underground radio. And we consistently need the support of the community, certainly in terms of donations. And I'll let you know in a bit where you can send those donations. Go to our website at freakradio.org for the schedule. Contact information in terms of the email address, phone number, etc., and a few other fascinating things on our newly made to look like it's completely revamped website. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz.
To be delivered from the cognitive pollution we've suffered through and lived among. Father, free us, intervene and lift the curse. Drench this tainted planet so our handicap can be reversed. And now below the bar we hear the panicked cries of dying men. Thrashing in the water, it's cutting off their oxygen. But we are spared, and providence will clearly show all the meek inherit is the doom of their genetic code. The finger pointing came from God, finding his creation flawed, decreed a final solution. Off you go, take a plunge, all of you have been expunged in the service of evolution. Our flagship. Second chance, it won't be long before the dove returns the olive branch. As for the dead, they only got what they deserved. It's all too obvious that God is creating on a curve. In his new kingdom, there isn't any simple niche. We won't need janitors or creeping drones to dig a dish. We chosen girl will sail ahead until we find the true potential in a cultivated human mind. An unencumbered tribe are we, devoid of mediocrity, every blemish amended. All of us rejoice in some, are plotting to become a little smarter than the Lord intended. Our flagship embarks to populate a world with perfect genes. Where now was new work, three standard deviations from me.
That was Noah's New Ark by Stuart Davis of Minnesota. I once saw it referred to as Minnesota's strangest son, Stuart Davis. That's Stuart Davis. Hello again. This is the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Ren Tawil, on Free Radio Santa Cruz for November 1st, the first day of November 2014, Saturday. Now, it's 11:08, and if all that jives with your personal time-space continuum, then you know that the show is live, 11:08 a.m. on November 1st. However, this being the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines, phone calls will not be taken, so I will not give the number out just yet. If you call, the ringers are silent and you will not be answered. The show goes until 1 o'clock this afternoon, and so I'll take a mid-show break, during which I will take your calls, but that's not for another 50 minutes or so. If you're just dying to get a message across to me, pop one off to this program's email address, MideastMadness@gmx.com. That's MideastMadness at G as in gorgeous, M as in malevolent. I just love saying that. X as in xenophobe.com, MideastMadness@gmx.com. The restriction on phone calls during the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines is due to the fact that for a good year now, in fact, it was, this is the 1st of November, and it was November of 2013 when I began reading Max Blumenthal's book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, that had just been released the month before. Took us some 6 months, I believe, to complete that book. And then just a few weeks ago, we finished Congressman Paul Finley's They Dare to Speak Out, People and Institutions Confront Israel's Lobby. That was a 1985 publication. Which had gone through two reprintings. I actually read from the 2003 edition, the third edition from 2003, so it was well updated, but still 11 years old. And I capped off the reading of the book, the end of the last chapter, with a short speech by Mr. Finley, who's still with us. He's in his 90s, some 93 or 94 years old, that he gave at the National Press Club last March. Now, if you missed any or all of those shows, go to my archives. I have two public archives for almost every show of Mideast Migraines. Missed a few because of technical problems in recording them. And possibly very, very early on, over 2 years ago. Gosh, we're going to about 2.5 years ago since I began this program under a different name. Did I simply neglect to record the shows? But we're, in terms of the book readings, they're pretty much all there. All the Goliath readings are available at one of two websites, available at both websites, radioforall.net. That's radio, R-A-D-I-O, the number four, you know, like the digital character four that you count to when you go 1, 2, 3, 4. Radioforall.net, radioforall.net, that's a .net. Go to that website, and it should be easy enough. Just type in Mideast Migraines. And the shows, most of them, the readings of Goliath, begin with the word Goliath in the title. Likewise, for They Dare to Speak Out, sometimes I simply refer to as DTSO, Dare to Speak Out. And that would precede the title of any given reading of the chapters. Again, at radioforall.net, and you may hear them audiobook style with a few of my added clarifications and embellishments. The other website is Santa Cruz Indie Bay, IndyBay. Go to Santa Cruz Indie Bay. I believe you need to click on Palestine, if you can find the word Palestine anywhere in there. The most recent readings are available on the main page. Look on the right margin of the main page in the long green box that pretty much extends the length of the main page, and find the latest readings and recordings of this program there. All right, what am I reading today? For those faithful listeners who have been paying attention, you'll know that this is the third week, the closing week, of reading a very short book, paperback. It's actually an anthology of 8 separate articles, an edited booklet of 8 articles, chapters, if you will. Every one of the authors of these are Jewish. And the book is entitled, this anthology is entitled, Reframing Anti-Semitism, Alternative Jewish Perspectives. And let me just read the front and back cover. Reviews. The eloquent testimonials in this myth-busting book are crucial reading for everyone concerned about Middle East peace. Chris Tensing, editor of Middle East Report. Here's another review. Jewish Voice for Peace is to be congratulated for producing this readable, refreshing, enlightening collection of articles. There is, in fact, more than one voice in these pages, the word voice in quotation marks, and this diversity is one of the strengths of the anthology. Some voices are more academic, others more activist. Some focus on the reality of contemporary anti-Semitism, others on the illusion. All in their different ways are Jewish voices speaking for peace and justice. Between them, they help, quote, reframe the question of anti-Semitism today, especially its relation to criticism of Israel. This is a complex subject dealt with sensitively by the contributors to Reframing Anti-Semitism. So says Brian Klug, St. Xavier University. Consulting editor of Patterns of Prejudice, published by the Institute for Jewish Policy Research in London. One last very short review here. This is probably the most telling and most important. Jewish Voice for Peace has done us all a great service by publishing this smart little book, which shows nicely how the charge of anti-Semitism is used these days to silence Jews and non-Jews who criticize Israel's policies in the occupied territories. So says John J. Mearsheimer, R. Wendell Harrison, Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science, University of Chicago. Now, once again, 8 articles in the anthology. I finished the first 6 and began reading 7. And I'm going to start from the beginning of 7 again. And as you have inferred by now, this booklet anthology was published by Jewish Voice for Peace in 2004, 10 years ago. Still totally pertinent today, quite obviously. Published by Jewish Voice for Peace. I'm going to take a very short musical break, and I'll be right back.
In my heart, this evil in my head, do not exist in equal parts, for only one is fair. A growing dark veneer, a conscience in repose. Tonight, as I was sleeping,
rest to guide and occupies my soul. But I never let it override the mind that I control. If I turn toward the light, its beauty cannot.
All right, this is the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM, streaming live on your computer through the internet at freakradio.org. Follow the instructions on the main page of our website for receiving the streaming link. All right. Beginning Article 7. And again, this program is being recorded. I expect it to be up on my archives within a week anyway. Article number 7. Historical U.S. anti-Semitism. The invisible oppression. Stereotyping, scapegoating, discounting. By Penny Rosenwasser. One more quick reminder. Two more reminders. Please, no telephone calls during the actual reading of the book. And I was roughly halfway through this chapter last Saturday before I had to end by the end of the program slot for Mideast Migraines. I'm simply starting again. Okay, historical U.S. anti-Semitism, the invisible oppression, stereotyping, scapegoating, discounting. Written by Penny Rosenwasser. Introduction. As charges of anti-Semitism are hurled by segments of the Jewish community in response to critiques of Israeli government policy, just as anti-Semitic incidents have increased since 9/11, how many of us are aware of what anti-Semitism has looked like in this country? Where it has shown up, when, and how? By no means a comprehensive examination, this brief overview highlights major patterns and areas of historical anti-Semitism in the United States. From stereotypes to scapegoating, quotas to a federal cover-up, physical violence to anti-Semitism on the left, is a story of bias and racism and Jewish vulnerability and Jewish resilience. Subheading, the creation of Jewish stereotypes. Negative stereotyping of Jews, just because they are Jews, was carried over from Europe and became a key manifestation of anti-Semitism in the United States. As early as 1836, the elementary textbook, well known to so many school children, the McGuffey Reader, portrayed Jews as greedy, sly, wicked, crafty, selfish, dishonest, and unethical. Of course, the most hideous charge was that Jews killed Christ and continued to use Christian children's blood for Jewish rituals. Charges compounded by a Jewish refusal to repent or convert. Underlying the stereotypes was the belief that Jews were enemies of Christians and were a people to be hated and feared. Jews have unfortunately internalized these attitudes, resulting in feelings of fear and self-hatred. Despite the fact that Sephardic Jews arrived in the Americas with Columbus, Jews have consistently been targeted as, quote, alien and, quote, different in this country. Though Jews were not the only ones treated this way, such prejudices have stayed under the surface during periods of calm, but in crises, Jews have often been feared as outsiders. For example, Mark Twain wrote about Jews, quote, "You will always be by ways and habit and predilection substantially strangers, foreigners, wherever you are, and that will probably keep the race prejudice against you alive," end quote. That's one of many attitudes Jews have had to face here. Just before the climax of U.S. anti-Semitism in the late 1930s to 1940s, a 1938 public opinion poll shows that 60% of those responding saw Jews as aggressive, greedy, and dishonest. By 1942, 42% of Americans polled said they did not want Jews moving into their neighborhood, second only to, quote, Negroes. And in 1946, when asked, have you heard any criticism of Jews in the last 6 months? 64% of those polled replied yes. New subheading, the stereotype of, quote, Jewish power. Of all the degrading stereotypes about Jews, the, quote, Jewish power stereotype is particularly potent. It is complicated by the realities that many U.S. Jews have gained some measure of economic, social, and or political power, while a much smaller percentage are poverty-stricken. But it is a stereotype far older than present-day United States, and it stems from the anti-Semitic dynamic, which is also the nature of stereotyping, of branding an entire group with what may be true for one or two individuals, of targeting the Jew, capital T, capital J, of targeting the Jew, and ignoring the powerful majority who are not Jewish. For example, in this country's history, some Jews have controlled a few major industries, but have been absent in, and perhaps even excluded from, many others. Is this truly Jewish, quote, power? The time period 1938 to 1945, which I, Ren here, will point out, happens to coincide almost exactly with the beginning and end of the Second World War. The time period 1938 to 1945 illustrates the complexities behind the quote-unquote Jewish power stereotype. According to polls of the period, almost 45% of the U.S. population believed that Jews had, quote, too much power, end quote, in commerce, business, and finance. And in fact, some Jews in the 1930s owned most of New York City's factories, retail, and wholesale establishment. Yet most Jews at this time are on the brink of poverty. In 1936, the Forbes magazine survey showed that Jewish executives were represented in the textile, film, and broadcasting industries, but were actually absent in the finance industry, as well as in insurance, steel, utilities, railroads, and autos, absent from all of those. The more visible Jews have become in the economy and in government. Yes, the more visible Jews have become in the economy and in government. Oh, I'm sorry, I've got to read this with the proper inflections. The more visible Jews have become in the economy and in government, the more they are targeted. Yet their attackers have also been condemned. When American hero Charles Lindbergh lambasted Jews in 1941, claiming, quote, their greatest danger lies in their large ownership and influence in our motion pictures, our press, our radio, and our government, end quote. When he said that, 93% of newspapers condemned Lindbergh's comments, along with protests from church and political leaders. The irony is that although Jews at this time were perceived as powerful, in truth they had little influence. As many have noted, if Jews had had real power, they would have been able to pressure the U.S. to admit Jewish refugees fleeing Hitler and to intervene in the death camps. In another example of the anti-Semitic dynamic of focusing on positions where Jews have gained systemic power and ignoring those areas where Jews are not represented, an American Jewish Committee survey in the mid-1970s showed one Jew among 377 senior banking executives. One in 377. Yet in 1981, 43% of Americans polled believed that Jews controlled international banking, and 30, 37% of thought Jews had too much power in the business world. Senator William Proxmire argued that, quote, no industry has been more consistently and cruelly rejected. No industry has more consistently and cruelly rejected Jews from positions of power and influence than commercial banking, end quote. In terms of documenting recent Jewish economic success, Jewish sociologist Riv Ellen Prell has reported estimates that 25% of Forbes 400 list for the year 2000 were Jews. That's for the year 2000. Most Jews live in a few large states, which control almost half of the Electoral College. Jews contribute up to half of Democratic campaign funds. Jewish representation in Congress has tripled. And Orthodox Jew Joseph Lieberman almost became vice president in the last presidential election. Remember, this is a 2004 reprint. The National Jewish Population Study 2001-03 reports that, and I quote, more than 60% of all employed Jews are in one of the three highest status job categories, end quote. The current median income of Jewish households is $54,000 as compared to the median U.S. household income of $42,000. 54 versus 42,000. This shows that anti-Semitism has not kept Jews from being allowed to prosper economically en masse or to achieve political power, just as economic prosperity does not mean that Jews are no longer targeted or blamed in hurtful and demeaning ways. In fact, because anti-Semitism is no longer an economic oppression in this country, let me read that again. So we know what kind of anti-Semitism she's talking about here. In fact, because anti-Semitism is no longer an economic oppression in this country, many people refuse to take it seriously, and it has become an invisible oppression. Meanwhile, a 2003 study by United Jewish Appeal Federation showed that 1 in 5 Jews living in New York City are living in poverty. 1 in 5. Many of whom are aging Jews, single mothers, and or Russian immigrants. Clearly, Jews have achieved a measure of economic, social, and political power, and even disproportionate power in a few industries relative to their percentage of the U.S. population. It is also true that the vast majority of institutional power in this country is still held by non-Jews. Jewish activist and author Paul Kibel points out how one of the ways that anti-Semitism works is that, quote, we are encouraged to see Jews more visibly than white Christians, so that our attention never quite focuses on the white Christian leadership of our government and corporations, so the economic roots of injustice remain unscathed, end quote. That is, there tends to be much more focus on any one Jew who has a modicum of power than on the majority of powerful non-Jews in any corporate boardroom, nonprofit organization, or governmental body. Categorizing the current U.S. ruling class is about 1% of the population, or 2.7 million people, with incomes beginning at $370,000 per year and minimal net worths of $2,045,000. Kivel also explains that, quote, there is a higher percentage of Jews in the ruling class, for example, the heads of DuPont, Disney, and Bank of America, than their representation in the general population. But despite the stereotypes, they still constitute a very small part of that class, end quote. The top 20% of the population, which includes the top 1% mentioned above, and the managerial class who implement ruling class policies are, quote, primarily white and Christian, although there are certainly distinct minorities of people of color, Jews, end quote, and others, end quote. That might have been a slight typo. (Clears throat) Even so, as recently as 1990, 21% of Christian Americans believed Jews had too much power in business. So, the Jewish power or Jewish money stereotypes actually serve to keep the focus on the small number of Jews who are part of the owning class rather than on the predominantly Christian nature of the U.S. owning class. By singling out Jews as scapegoats, instead of focusing on those who are making decisions at the highest levels, anti-Semitism masks what is really class antagonism. As Cavell points out, and I quote, "Whenever the stereotypes of Jewish money or power go unchallenged, the injustice of our economic system is strengthened and racism is continued. Blaming Jewish bankers or African-American women on welfare are parallel strategies to divert our attention from the corporate elite that makes the economic decisions that affect our lives. These strategies give the majority of white people the mistaken impression that they are controlled by Jews and in competition with people of color, squeezed on both sides," end quote. New subheading, "Stereotypes which target Jewish women from the Gentile and Jewish communities." A reminder, I am reading from a publication by Jewish Voice for Peace, headquartered here in the Bay Area of California. Anthology of articles, "Reframing Anti-Semitism, Alternative Jewish Perspectives," 2004. Subheading, "Stereotypes which target Jewish women from the Gentile and Jewish communities." Various Jewish feminist writers point out the stereotypes created by Jewish men and then adopted by the rest of society, which demean Jewish women. Although not excusable, it is a way that Jewish men have responded to the anti-Semitism directed at them and then projecting it onto Jewish women. Riv Ellen Prell explains that, quote, "Gentiles blame Jews and Jews blame Jewish women," end quote. The, quote, "Jewish mother" stereotype is an example of such misogyny. As Jews were allowed to become upwardly mobile after World War II, as a result of the benefits of the GI Bill of Rights, the 1944 Servicemen's Readjustment Act, Jewish mothers were blamed for all the feelings of anxiety and ambivalence brought up by assimilation into middle-class whiteness. The Jewish mother was mocked as a perversion of Jewish love and strength, as being too powerful, manipulative, suffocating, needy, and nurturing, and as dominating Jewish husbands and sons into silence. As dominating Jewish husbands and sons into silence. That's the stereotype. This also fit into the general, quote, mother-bashing mode of the 1950s, exemplified by Dr. Spock, Dr. Benjamin Spock. Of course, the JAP, or Jewish American Princess, is a horrific example of the culmination of misogyny against Jewish women, a stereotype seemingly created by Jewish men, but perpetuated by non-Jews. Seen as young, affluent, materialistic, entitled, and obnoxious, she is targeted as deviant and undesirable, with endless needs, and has been particularly attacked on college campuses, where football crowds have screamed, J.A.P., when certain young women walk by. One theory is that the J.A.P. was created by a culture of consumers who needed to blame their own materialistic excesses on some distinct group. Jewish feminist activist and writer Melanie K. Kantrowitz calls the J.A.P., quote, "a sexist scapegoating of Jewish middle-class women for the crimes of capitalism," end quote. Fortunately, Jewish women artists have defied this stereotype by creating women characters who are witty, empowered, and independent. Subheading, "Jews as scapegoats, Jewish vulnerability, Jews as buffers, and the, quote, socialism of fools." Even though Jews have been less discriminated against in the U.S. than in Europe, as well as being given new opportunities and sometimes even being accepted during economic or societal crises, Jews have often been blamed as the cause of the problem. Still today, Jews who are landlords, small business people, teachers, social workers, doctors, lawyers, managers, and government bureaucrats are sometimes attacked for being in positions of control over others while also serving as the public faces of, or buffers for, the policy setters and big decision makers, the sources of institutional power. New subheading, Jewish feelings of vulnerability. Jews often look like they have power because they are, quote, set up in intermediary positions between those on the bottom rungs of society and those in charge. The way the scapegoating pattern works is that groups who are visibly oppressed don't see the heads of corporations. They see the middle-level Jewish managers, business people, and professionals. And they are fed the stereotypes of Jews as controlling Congress, Hollywood, and the media. When something goes wrong, people on the lower rungs are then urged to blame Jews rather than holding those at the top of the ladder responsible. In 1969, James Baldwin described it as the Jew, and I quote, playing the role assigned to him by Christians long ago. He is doing their dirty work, end quote. It's interesting how they use the acronym SIC for spelling incorrect when he used the word him and he, inferring that it could be a her or a she. Again, 1969, James Baldwin described it, this phenomenon, as the Jew, quote, playing the role assigned to him or her by Christians long ago. He or she is doing their dirty work, end quote. Now, how else would you succinctly note that it should be a gender-neutral statement? Anyway, continuing with the book. This leads to what is distinctive about anti-Semitism, how Jews often feel very vulnerable to an unpredictable attack, parenthetically, because this has been true historically as well as in the present. Even though from the outside it looks like their position is secure and even powerful. Jews may accept positions in which they are the visible face of those doing the real damage in an effort to find secure footing. Evelyn Tortenbeck, who wrote the groundbreaking anthology Nice Jewish Girls, suggests that this scapegoating pattern understandably leaves Jews feeling wary and insecure. Here's a quote from that work. If at certain moments in history some Jews have entered into the mainstream, it is only because some powerful groups have, quote, allowed it. Often this is done with the purpose of using Jews as a buffer and or as an easy scapegoat when one is needed. It is an age-old pattern for Jews, today allowed in, perhaps even encouraged, tomorrow ignominiously thrown out. Many people fail to understand the implications of this recurrent fact of Jewish history, refusing to acknowledge the precariousness of Jewish existence. Is that why even now I feel I have to justify my concern to prove that any form of anti-Semitism is always a real danger? End of quotation from Evelyn Tortenbeck. Jews are clearly not the only group scapegoated. In these times of fierce repression against immigrants, welfare mothers, and people who are Muslim or of Arab descent, along with Jews, Kay Kantrovitz points out that Japanese, Koreans, Arabs, Indians, and Pakistanis are also branded as, quote, money grubbing, while young disenfranchised men of color are blamed for societal problems. Quote, one group is blamed for capitalism's crimes, the other for capitalism's fallout, she observes, and says, do I need to point out who escapes all blame? New subheading, examples of anti-Semitic scapegoating in the United States. The worst periods of anti-Semitic scapegoating in this country have been during times of economic strain, societal unrest, and fear. During the Civil War, the Great Depression, and the period prior to and during World War II. Just before the Civil War, Northern newspapers attacked Jewish financiers as, and I quote, hooked-nosed wretches, accusing them of war profiteering. In 1862, General Ulysses Grant expelled all Jews from his Western Tennessee military district following army scandals in which Jews participated but were in the minority. Their physical difference visibly marked them, however, and so they were most targeted. President Lincoln later rescinded Grant's order, only to be followed by the Confederate House of Representatives denouncing Jews, while some southern towns expelled Jews for being disloyal and not pro-slavery enough. During the Great Depression, Henry Ford's paper, The Dearborn Independent, reprinted in 1920 the mythological Rabbi's Letter, which supposedly appeared in turn-of-the-century Russia through the Tsarist secret police. This letter announced a Jewish conspiracy to take over the world and seize all wealth. Known as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, it was a vicious manifesto based on historic anti-Semitic stereotypes of Jewish power. The Independent published 91 weeks of attacks on Jews, blaming them for controlling U.S. media and banks, and predicting a Jewish takeover of the country. Just as Americans were plunged in financial crisis, uncertainty, and fear, the paper's circulation skyrocketed in urban working class and rural areas, just as prominent Americans and journalists denounced the manifesto. Although the, quote, protocols were eventually exposed as a fraud, they are still in distribution. From 1933 to 1939, the most virulent Jewish oppression yet in the U.S. exploded in response to the economic crisis and the Nazi takeover of power in Germany. Father Charles Coughlin, a charismatic priest with the National Union for Social Justice, drew an unprecedented following from those traumatized by the Depression, mostly from the poor and working classes, by instilling in them fear of a communist Jewish takeover. Communist/Jewish takeover. He also blamed Jews for Germany's economic woes, portrayed Hitler as Europe's savior, and minimize the brutal 1938 Kristallnacht attack on Jews in Germany, the most extensive pogrom in history. By 1941, over 100 U.S. anti-Semitic organizations had formed where only a handful existed before. And as President Roosevelt had opened opportunities for Jews in high office, including Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis and presidential advisor Felix Frankfurter, Jews were blamed for the New Deal, and Roosevelt was accused of selling out the country to the Jews. Fascinating, since I believe the New Deal was responsible for pulling us out of the Depression. Anyway, continuing. Polls of the era testify to the extent of anti-Jewish feeling. In 1938, half of Americans polled held Jews responsible for Hitler's treatment of them. And 45% thought poorly of Jews. By the 1940s, 43% said they would support an anti-Jewish campaign. Riv Ellen Prell even argues that a greater percentage of Americans had negative attitudes about Jews than about Germans or Japanese, with whom the U.S. was at war, and this at a time when Germany was annihilating Jews by the millions. Finally, numerous Jewish as well as non-Jewish leftists were attacked as communists by McCarthyism, brought before the House Un-American Activities Committee, and blacklisted, ruining many lives. It's 11:49 in the a.m. here, Saturday, November 1st, 2014. Going to grab some throat spray here. You're listening to the Mideast Migraine Show. Mideast Migraines on Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM and streaming live at freakradio.org. I'm your host, Rent Wheel. This program comes to you every Saturday at 11 a.m. The other edition of Mideast Migraines every Monday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Both shows about 2 hours long. Please consider sending your donations to keep this vital grassroots community radio service alive and well. Check or money order only, please. That, by the way, is my tribute to Halloween, the creaky microphone boom. There's my Halloween salutation for you. Please send your donations to the following: Free Radio Santa Cruz, or simply write on the envelope, FRSC, Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, two words, Santa and C-R-U-Z, California, zip code 95061. That's 95061. Again, send it, your donation, no cash, please. Check or money orders to FRSC, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And it is 11:51 a.m. Okay, continuing. New subheading, Institutional Jewish Oppression, Doors Slamming Shut. Institutional Jewish Oppression, Doors Slamming Shut. After Sephardic Jews from Spain and Portugal landed here with Columbus, the second largest immigration wave of Jews, primarily Ashkenazi Jews from Central and Western Europe, arrived in the 1840s. A third wave of Jewish immigrants escaping pogroms in Russia and Eastern Europe hit American shores in the 1880s, comprising 10% of the 23 million immigrants who fled here up until 1914. This established a significant Jewish presence in America, initiating a dynamic that was to continue. Increased population of Jews, or increased Jewish visibility, leading to increased Jewish oppression. Implemented by upper-class Americans who did not want Jews around, they legislated institutional barriers to keep Jews from infiltrating upper-crust Christian society, effectively excluding Jews from certain private schools, clubs, and resorts, as well as from housing developments and occupations. Harvard led elite universities in instituting a quota system against Jewish students to keep them from undermining wealthy Protestant bastions of social distinction, and by 1930, many private Eastern schools had followed suit. Of all the new immigrants, the Jews were most repellent because not only were they not Christian, but it was feared they would take over economic and political power. New subheading, immigration restrictions on Jews and anti-Jewish racism. Although Chinese immigrants were the first to be prohibited because of their nationality, in 1882, by 19... Okay, let's start again. Although Chinese immigrants were the first to be prohibited because of their nationality in 1882, by 1924 to 27, the first massive immigration restrictions in this country limited all Asians and Jews, along with other Southern and Eastern European immigrants. The largest allotments were given to presumably non-Jewish immigrants from Great Britain, Ireland, and Germany. These restrictions reflected a xenophobic response to economic crisis, compounded by racism and anti-Semitism. Specifically, in the late 1800s, racial determinism ideas swept through Europe and into the United States by the early 1900s. This pseudo, quote, scientific or, quote, objective racism insisted that Jews' biology was inferior, reflecting their moral inferiority, thus justifying their oppression. Austrian journalist Wilhelm Marr, who was one of many scientific intellectuals in Germany who divided the world according to race, and who himself was the son of a Jew who converted, first coined the term anti-Semitism in 1873. Jewish Voice for Peace co-director Mitchell Plitnik explains that, quote, Marr's coining of the phrase intended to establish a new vicious theory as to why Jews are the enemy, and to give the hatred of Jews a more palatable nickname than Judenhass, end quote. In America, such scientific racism categorized all immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe as racially inferior, not just Jews. Though of this group, Jews were seen as the major threat to Anglo-Saxon supremacy. Polls from the period reflect these attitudes. Despite Nazi Germany's state-sponsored Jewish oppression, which began in the early 1930s, by 1938, 77% of Americans polled believed that more Jewish refugees from Germany should be barred from entering the U.S. In 1939, 66% disagreed with allowing 10,000 Jewish refugee children to immigrate over the U.S. quota limits. And although several congresspeople proposed bringing over refugee children from Europe, President Roosevelt refused, saying he did not want to alienate popular opinion. By 1941, very few immigrants were allowed through America's gates, including Jews. And in 1943, 78% of Americans objected to allowing more immigrants into the country after the war. At the end of 1945, when word was out about the disastrous conditions faced by displaced refugees, only 5% supported raising immigration quotas. New subheading. The U.S. State Department's attempted cover-up of the, quote, final solution. America's door is still closed. But not only did the U.S. drastically reduce the number of Jewish refugees escaping Hitler who were allowed into the country, the State Department initially tried to cover up word of Hitler's genocide against European Jews. Holocaust historian Michael Berenbaum exposes the story, which began in early August 1942, when German industrialist Edward Schulte leaked word that Hitler planned to kill all of Europe's Jews, launching his final solution to the, quote, Jewish problem. To World Jewish Congress, WJC, Swiss representative Dr. Gerhard Rigner tried to contact WJC President Rabbi Stephen Wise through secure channels, only to have his message intercepted by the U.S. State Department. When Wise later heard the news from the British, the State Department confirmed it, but asked Wise not to publicize the information until it was reconfirmed that fall. Even then, America's doors were not open to Jews fleeing Hitler. Subsequently, the State Department sent a cable to U.S. consulates in neutral countries to close the secret communication channel, signaling a disinterest by the State Department in the Jews' fate. Meanwhile, Polish secret courier Jan Karski toured the U.S. from 1943 to 45 in a desperate effort to publicize what he had learned about the massive murder of European Jews. Meeting with Roosevelt, Rabbi Wise, a prominent journalists, he also published a book about the Warsaw Ghetto, which became a Book of the Month Club selection. By 1943, word was out about Hitler's plan to exterminate all European Jews. Yet congressional resolutions, which would have provided refuge to the prospective victims, never even made it to a vote.
Uh-oh.
Little nuisance signal to me there. Find my page again. Never even made it to a vote. Thanks, however, to diligent research by Treasury Department lawyer Josiah Dubois, which exposed the State Department's cover-up of the final solution. On January 13, 1944, U.S. Treasury Department officials sent Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau a memo called, quote, "The acquiescence of this government in the murder of the Jews," end quote. Finally, Roosevelt set up a war refugee board, which had to be privately funded, but which eventually succeeded in saving about 200,000 Jews. Once again, I am reading from the 2004 Jewish Voice for Peace publication, an anthology of articles, Reframing Anti-Semitism, Alternative Jewish Perspectives. In addition to the recorded readings of this show of the book, you may call Jewish Voice for Peace at the following phone number if you are interested in acquiring a copy or copies for yourself. Phone number, area code 510-465-1777. Again, area code 510-465-1777. Or for more copies, contact us at info@jewishvoiceforpeace.org. info@jewishvoiceforpeace.org. It's 2 minutes past 12 o'clock noon. New subheadings. Subheading: Physical Violence Against Jews. Compared to people of color in this country, Jews have experienced little physical violence, and none of it has been state-sponsored. Foremost was the Georgia lynching of Jewish factory owner Leo Frank in 1913, who was also president of the local B'nai B'rith chapter. Set up by false testimony, he was convicted of murdering 13-year-old worker Mary Fagan. After his death sentence was commuted to life imprisonment, the enraged community kidnapped him from the prison farm and murdered him. 3,000 Jews fled Georgia soon afterwards. Washington Post reporter Kathy Sawyer recently uncovered that the Frank lynching was committed by some of Marietta, Georgia's most prestigious townspeople, as revealed in deathbed confessions to their families. By all accounts, the lynching was well-planned and coldly calculated, and it led to the reinvigoration of the Ku Klux Klan, while simultaneously helping build B'nai B'rith's Anti-Defamation League. Meanwhile, as Jews were being rounded up and gassed in Eastern Europe, gangs of Father Coughlin's right-wing anti-communist United Christian Front attacked Jewish adults and children on the streets of Boston and New York, desecrating synagogues and Jewish cemeteries, and vandalizing Jewish-owned businesses. And although the War Refugee Board, backed by numerous Jewish organizations, frantically urged the federal government to bomb railway lines to Auschwitz, no action was taken. Michael Barenbaum insists that by May 1944, the U.S. government knew what was happening in Auschwitz and that the Air Force had the capability for such a mission, at one point dropping over 1,000 bombs on a factory nearby. Instead, they focused on defeating the Nazis, a defeat which came too late to save millions of lives. Arguably, the decision to do nothing else to save the victims' lives can be seen as culpability akin to violence. I'll read that again. Instead, they focused on defeating the Nazis, a defeat which came too late to save millions of lives. Arguably, the decision to do nothing else to save the victims' lives can be seen as culpability akin to violence. In the post-war period, the U.S. executed young Jewish communists Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, who were victims of Cold War anti-communist hysteria, combined with anti-Semitism. Accused of conspiring to sell classified atomic secrets to the Russians, the evidence against them was inconclusive. Meanwhile, Jewish temples were bombed in the South in 1957 to 58. And in 1964, two young white Jewish civil rights workers, Michael Schwerner and Andrew Goodman, were murdered along with their African-American colleague, James Cheney. As recently as the summer of 1999, three synagogues were firebombed in Sacramento, California. Orthodox Jews were viciously assaulted in Chicago, and Jewish school children were critically shot in an attack on a Los Angeles Jewish day school. Significantly, each of these crimes was also connected to fatal attacks on gay men or people of color. New subheading: Anti-Semitism on the Left. As Michael Lerner reminds us, and that would be Rabbi Michael Lerner reminds us, anti-Semitism is most to be feared from the conservative Christian right, not from the left. And the left has been a key voice in acknowledging anti-Semitism as an ongoing oppression with a commitment to eliminating it. That said, many leading progressive Jewish activists, from Lerner to Irena Klepfiz, whose father died helping lead the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, admonished the left, non-Jews and Jews alike, for buying into the assumption that Jews, as Jews, are bidding for vast control in the world and are some of those most responsible for world problems. A major critique across the left, including the women's movement, of consistently discounting Jewish oppression and branding those who raise the issue A major critique accuses the left, including the women's movement, of consistently discounting Jewish oppression and branding those who raise the issue self-indulgent or competing for, quote, victim status. Those who call attention to anti-Semitism can be accused of diverting energy from more important struggles, implying that there is not enough room on a progressive agenda for Jewish oppression. And parenthetically, she says, note, this is a complex issue, since white Jewish leftists sometimes do unawarely subvert anti-racist agendas to instead focus on Jewish oppression, thus showing their white privilege. This Jewish racism is often the result, however, of the anti-Semitism of ignoring and or diminishing the importance of Jewish pain, which does not excuse the racism of the agenda diversion. Close parentheses. Part of the discounting includes the left not taking seriously those who speak from a place of heartfelt connection to their Jewishness. Leftist anti-Semitism can also show itself as singling out Israel for its horrific human rights abuses without acknowledging that Israel is not the only state committing atrocities. Need to remind ourselves of Colombia, Burma, Zaire, Afghanistan, including the U.S. treatment of Iraqi people? Related to this is the way that Jews are either expected to be, quote, better, or are seen as worse than others, but not as human beings like everyone else, with many strengths and a few gnarly spots as well. And human rights activist Susan Freudlich points out that, quote, where anti-Semitism really shows itself is in the spilling over of the rightful condemnation of Israeli government policies into the hatred of Jewish people as a whole, where the criticism of a policy becomes the blanket condemnation of a people, end quote. Okay. Jewish Voice for Peace co-director Liat Weingart recently wrote about the lack of understanding of Jewish oppression in the progressive movement, including, and I quote, the enormous cost that we have paid to make ourselves invisible in the larger society and on the left for fear of being scapegoated for the corrupt policies of either the U.S. or Israel, end quote. She referred to non-Jewish leftist colleagues who blame Jews for, quote, the horrific policies of the government of Israel, though we are fighting those policies, end quote, as well as blaming Jews, quote, for controlling the media for initiating a war with Iraq, end quote. When she pointed out that these statements have, quote, undercurrents of anti-Semitism, she has been met with denial. Calling for the issue of anti-Semitism to be part of the agenda of a progressive movement, along with other oppressions, she explained that, quote, anti-Semitism is different than other forms of oppression. The existence of Jews in positions of power in this country does not mean that anti-Semitism does not exist, end quote. When Jewish oppression is discounted, Jews absorb the message to be silent and to ignore the invisibility and vulnerability Jews may feel as Jews. It's useful to remember here, as communities working together for a social justice agenda, the words of Chicana activist and writer Sherry Moraga, who reminded a multicultural group of Jews and non-Jews to take each take responsibility for their own ignorance and to, quote, refuse to give up on each other. We're almost done with this lengthy article and opinion, as well researched as it is. Last subheading, conclusion, resisting victimization. The good news is that despite the accelerated, brutal repression of the Israeli government towards Palestinians, which I, in parentheses, she says, which I suggest is a function of unhealed Jewish fear as a response to centuries of persecution, a fear manipulated by despots. But that is the subject of another article, explanation point, close parentheses, which has brought more anti-Semitism to the surface. U.S. Jews are not victims any longer. The short version of that paragraph, the good news is that despite the accelerated brutal repression of the Israeli government towards Palestinians, which has brought more anti-Semitism to the surface, U.S. Jews are not victims any longer. In this country, the United States, most Jews have gained economic stability, civil rights, and political power. In 1958, anti-Semitism was finally eliminated from all prayers by Pope John the 13th. I'm sorry, by Pope John the 23rd. XXIII. And in 1965, the Second Vatican Council officially exonerated Jews for the death of Christ, repudiating the idea that Jews were rejected by God for not accepting Jesus as Savior. And just as the Holocaust has become the historical experience which unites American Jews, it is also true that anti-Semitism is not integrated into a broadly accepted political philosophy in this country. It is not true that anti-Semitism is not integrated into a broadly accepted political philosophy in this country. Anti-Semitism is not integrated. Yet, of course, it is more complicated than that. U.S. Jews must still contend with what Melanie K. Kontrovitz calls, quote, Christianism, a system that honors and rewards everything Christian, thus marginalizing and sometimes targeting everything non-Christian. But Jews can also ally with other non-Christians to combat this oppression. And as K. Kantrowitz also reminds us, while Jewish oppression has been somewhat mitigated since World War II by the development of some institutional Jewish power, often it is this very success for which Jews are blamed. While anti-Semitism works to single out Jews and make Jews visible, anti-Semitism itself remains invisible to most non-Jews, which serves to make Jews feel only more exposed. Hurtful stereotypes, insidious scapegoating, the disregard of anti-Semitism, and occasional violence continue battering Jewish self-esteem and heightening Jewish feelings of vulnerability, even though externally Jews appear successful and secure, and in fact are standing on much more solid ground than ever before. Because it's also true that Jews are here, Jews have survived, and many Jews are thriving. As Jews who care about Jews here and about Jews in Israel, we need to confront all the complexities, the reality of past Jewish oppression, and how Jews still carry fear from that experience, especially the Holocaust, the current increase in anti-Semitic incidents in Europe, the reality of relative Jewish security here in the United States, despite a recent rise in anti-Semitism, and the reality of Israeli government policies against Palestinians that are only bringing more Israeli deaths and less security for Israel. Just as anti-Semitism has been rising, anti-Arab racism inside Israel is rising as well, just as racism in this country has exploded against Muslims and people of Arab descent since 9/11, which is to say, of course, since 2001. As Jews with a proud heritage of social justice, we cannot let ourselves take comfort in the badge of victimization. When we target anti-Semitism, we must also target racism in this country and in Israel. And as Jews, let's notice how our fear can paralyze us. Let's acknowledge that old place inside us that starts to feel, quote, everyone hates the Jews, end quote. It's not our fault if we feel this way. But this time, let's work through these feelings so that we don't take out our fear or grief or outrage against any other people, be they Palestinian or Muslim or African American or Jewish. We deserve compassion and understanding just as we need to offer that to others. Let's stand against the oppression of Jews and the oppression of Palestinians, against the oppression of all people who are marginalized because of their skin color or ethnicity or social class or body size or gender or sexual orientation or age or disability. Let's value all lives as precious and worth protecting and not allow any people to be demeaned or vilified. Let's do all we can to build a movement for peace and justice for all peoples, not a movement of hatred towards any people. Let's build alliances and bridges between us, not walls and buffer zones. And that actually is the end of the text of the article. She has a huge listing of sources here. I probably won't read all of them, but I'll start at The Rising Cost of Whiteness by Melanie K. Kantrowitz. Anti-Semitism in America by Leonard Dienerstein. Fighting to Become Americans by Reeve Ellen Prell. The Ethnic Myth by Steven Steinberg. Pluralism and Its Discontents by Cheryl Greenberg. Jewish Power by J.J. Goldberg. Uprooting Racism, Who Decides, Who Benefits, Who Pays, A Guide to the U.S. Ruling Class Power Elite. That is a working title in publication by Paul Cavell. Yeah, a long one. Uprooting Racism and Who Decides, Who Benefits, Who Pays, A Guide to the U.S. Ruling Class Power Elite. And many, many more. Author of this article, Penny Rosenwasser, herself, is completing her doctoral dissertation on the psychological effects of anti-Semitism on Jews. She published Voices from a Promised Land in subquotes, Palestinian and Israeli Peace Activists Speak Their Hearts, Curbstone Press, 1992. She belongs to Kehila Synagogue and is a member of the Coordinating Committee of Jewish Voice for Peace. Very, very long piece, probably the longest single article in this anthology. And here it is already, 12:21. I feel like there's a lot that I can say about this piece. First of all, for someone who most assuredly sides with the Palestinian narrative and tends to side in terms of peace and justice with the Palestinian and Palestinians in terms of highlighting their suffering and the rights that they have, I must feel that I felt rather strange reading this, going into great depth about the nature of anti-Semitism both here and abroad, according to Ms. Rosenwasser. Certainly do not want to refute her attempt to flesh out, as she entitled the article, Historical U.S. Anti-Semitism, the Invisible Oppression, Stereotyping, Scapegoating, and Discounting. She does indeed go into a great deal of depth here. I did constantly find myself wanting to argue against what I saw as Rosenwasser's lessening of Jewish power in some quarters, as she identified them in the article, and perhaps putting way too much emphasis on the whole subject of this inner Jew who, as she puts it, starts to feel everyone hates the Jews. Of course, that is a problem. although I still, personally, I really think it's extremely important for Jews to, along with the other recommendations that the author has here, I think it's important for Jews to put a lot more effort into getting out of this, any sense of self-hatred, just as they should do what they can to emerge from any self of entitlement, according to past mass crimes against the Jews, Russian pogroms, Christian persecution, the Nazi Holocaust, is undeniable as this history is. It's extremely important for them not to fall back on using that as an excuse to do some of the things that they may do. Again, this is my feeling, my partial analysis of the article. It's what she says here is very wide-ranging and overwhelmingly true. There's no question about it. Please don't take what I'm saying as a total condemnation of the article. It is not a condemnation of the article. One example is that I really do feel that even though Jews do not control the economy of the United States, and even though there is no serious conspiracy of Jews to take over the world, I still believe that she, if anything, is avoiding discussion and acknowledgement of the fact that there is a great deal of American Jewish as well as Israeli Jewish lobby control of the U.S. Congress and the U.S. government in terms of how the United States supports Israel and supports Israel's military or supports Israeli government policies and thereby effectively supports its military. I feel I have a right to say that, considering I read the whole article in all sincerity, word for word, when I get my words straight here. Okay, here's the phone number. It's 25 after 12, way past the midpoint. The phone number for the studio here, area code. Almost gave my personal Minneapolis area code. Area code for Santa Cruz County, 831-427-3772. Again, area 831-427-3772. The lines are open.
as I waved goodbye in a teary blur. You pulled some strings, the stewardess sat you next to her. In a gentle voice, with an affecting tone, you touched her hand on the armrest over the first time zone. Crossing over oceans will break down boundaries, won't it? Like any worldly man, you knew that and you seized the moment. Well, I was feeling sick, trying not to miss her. At the terminal in Amsterdam, you grabbed her and you kissed her. But don't overestimate how wounded I should be. She pretended you were me.
Man, Stu Davis again there. Stu Davis of Minnesota. That album, entitled Nomen Est Numen, To Name Is To Know, is about 20 years old now. Perhaps closer to 25 years. Remarkable artist and lyricist. I like his music. I like his voice. I'm most attracted to the words of his songs. This man not only has conviction, but a lot of brains and ideas, and knows how to get them across in a very artful way. Stuart Davis. This is the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Underground pirate grassroots community radio for the real community, not compliant with the FCC. We broadcast at 101.3 FM and stream live at freakradio.org. That's freakradio.org. The final article to be read now, only 7 pages long, and I've got about 20 to 25 minutes to do it. Let's finish up this book. As it turns out, even 2 articles, including that last, perhaps longest one in the entire anthology, 2 articles really take up a lot of time, including, of course, my comments and closing opinions about what I just read. Let's get this 7-page article out. The closing article of Reframing Anti-Semitism, Alternative Jewish Perspectives, published by Jewish Voice for Peace in 2004. Inquire Jewish Voice for Peace to acquire your own copy of Reframing Anti-Semitism. Here we go. Article 8. Is Criticizing Israel Anti-Semitic? By Chuck Scheer. This paper is a response to the claim that the Petaluma Progressives' weekly downtown protests, quote, express hatred against the state of Israel, end quote, as counter-demonstrators claim. As the founder of the Progressives, I would respectfully disagree with this assessment. Here's why. As a Jew, his name is Chuck Scheer, as a Jew, I understand the fear that our people have for the safety of fellow Jews, and I know the distrust that this fear can create. There are certainly centuries of persecution to back up these feelings. But approaching the world out of fear can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Instead of creating security, it can create overreaction, callousness toward the suffering of others, and a justification of the use of excessive force, which then turns into an endless cycle of violence and revenge. This is what is happening in Palestine and Israel, especially in the last 3 years of Ariel Sharon's exclusive use of force as the sole approach to a very complex set of problems. Palestinian suicide bombings are also an utterly reprehensible tactic, and hundreds of innocent Israeli lives have been needlessly killed in the current fighting. It is even possible that there would already be a just peace in place if the Palestinians had been able to mount a sustained, nonviolent response to the Israeli occupation. The fact that they didn't is a real tragedy for both peoples. So, why don't we put equal blame on the Palestinians for the ongoing violence? There are several good reasons for this. Number one, Israel's violence is of a different order. Israel's army is the fourth largest in the world. A reminder, this I'm reading from an article in an anthology that was published 10 years ago, 2004, and I believe the current figure is Israel's army is now the sixth largest in the world, but I could be wrong. He says here, Israel's army is the fourth largest in the world, with state-of-the-art military equipment supplied by billions of our tax dollars every year. For the last year, the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, has systematically terrorized the Palestinian population, injuring over 20,000 Palestinians, keeping millions locked in their houses with little respite for months at a time, destroying their economy, which has led to widespread malnutrition, destroying every vestige of Palestinian civil society, cultural centers, government offices, having nothing to do with resistance to the occupation. Government offices having nothing to do with resistance to the occupation, daycare centers, etc. Palestinian suicide missions are a sign of Palestinian weakness, not strength. A last-ditch measure of desperation carried out by people who can no longer tolerate their homes, families, and friends being blown up around them. Speaking of Palestinians. Reason number two. Israel initiated the current level of lethal force. As of 2004, there was sporadic Palestinian violence during the Oslo years, but nothing like the magnitude we've seen in the last 3 years, and even that was in response to Israeli violence, like Baruch Goldstein's massacre of 29 Muslim worshippers in a mosque in Hebron, 1994. Of course, those Muslims being Palestinian Arabs. Continuing, far from orchestrating this violence, Arafat's Palestinian Authority, the PA, during the Oslo years was arresting and torturing Hamas militants on Israel's behalf, an activity that became politically and even physically impossible once Israeli forces reoccupied most of the West Bank in the current fighting. The current intifada started with Ariel Sharon's provocative visit to the Al-Aqsa Mosque with 1,000 Israeli armed guards in tow. The following day, there was a predictable Palestinian demonstration in Jerusalem, which the Israeli police could have dispersed using non-lethal means, but they didn't. They opened fire on the crowd, leaving at least 6 Palestinians dead and hundreds injured. During the next month, 125 Palestinians were killed, mostly unarmed demonstrators throwing rocks at well-defended Israeli soldiers on Palestinian territory, by the way, not in Israel itself. Only after this had gone on for a month did the first suicide bombing in the current intifada occur. There is a crucial fact that belies the claim that Israeli actions are, quote-unquote, in response to suicide bombings. This is a crucial fact that belies that claim. As Human Rights Watch reported at the time, quote, Israeli security forces have committed by far the most serious and systematic violations. We documented excessive and indiscriminate use of lethal force, arbitrary killings, and collective punishment that far exceed any possible military necessity, end quote. Reason number three for not putting equal blame on the Palestinians for the ongoing violence. Correcting U.S. media bias. One sign at our vigil states, innocent Palestinians are being shot every day. This is merely a statement of fact. 80 Palestinians were killed in the first week of March alone. And over 2,000 Palestinians have been killed in the past 3.5 years. The majority of them unarmed people killed by IDF troops who have opened fire at demonstrations, at firefighters trying to put out fires, Palestinian firefighters being fired upon, at medical personnel trying to evacuate the wounded, at journalists, UN relief workers, at an elderly person on a donkey who wandered into a, quote, closed military area. People killed when their homes were demolished around them. People killed by Israeli snipers for the crime of venturing outdoors during extended, quote, curfew periods. People killed by bombs dropped on crowded apartment buildings. Kids killed by Israeli tanks while throwing rocks, and on and on. In parentheses here. As for the claim that only terrorists are being targeted, for one, it is patently untrue. And for two, the Israeli government has no legal or moral right to be the judge, jury, and executioner of, quote, suspected militants who were assassinated without due process, without the right of defense, etc. This policy of Sharon's is completely illegal under international law, close parentheses. Our corporate media has prominent headlines, photos, and TV footage whenever there are Israeli victims of random violence, but severely downplays or totally ignores the much more frequent and systematic violence perpetrated by the Israeli government. Our sign is an attempt to rectify this imbalance. Reason number four. The illegal Israeli occupation of Palestinian land is, in itself, a series of acts of violence. Just as armed robbery is an act of violence. Even if no one is hurt, the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza has been one long series of forcible expropriations of Palestinian land. This was made possible by the unconditional diplomatic support of the U.S. government since 1972, which has allowed Israel to ignore the overwhelming consensus of world opinion that their occupation of Palestinian land is illegal under international law. At this point, well over 50% of the occupied territories consist of illegal Jewish-only settlements, Jewish-only bypassed roads, and closed Israeli military areas. Israel's illegal occupation... Last reason number five. Israel's illegal occupation is the root cause of the violence. And so their refusal to dismantle that occupation means they have the lion's share of the responsibility for the continuation of the violence. As Israel's former Attorney General, Michael Ben-Yair, wrote in Haaretz, March 3, 2002, quote, "We enthusiastically choose to become a colonial society, ignoring international treaties, expropriating lands, transferring settlers from Israel to the occupied territories, engaging in theft and finding justification for all these activities. In effect, we established an apartheid regime in the occupied territories immediately following their capture. That oppressive regime exists to this day," end quote. An admission of Israel's former Attorney General, Michael Ben-Yair, or Ben-Yair. Continuing, Israel might be faulted for overzealousness, Israel might be faulted for overzealousness, but not ultimate responsibility for the conflict if the Palestinians were an implacable enemy, unwilling to negotiate a reasonable peace agreement. But this myth, while perhaps comforting to some, is simply historically inaccurate. Since 1988, when the Palestinian Authority officially accepted Israel's right to exist in peace and security within their pre-1967 borders, there have been numerous chances to trade land for peace, all of which Israel rejected out of hand. Most recently, the entire Arab League, including the Palestinian Authority, unanimously voted in March of 2002 to endorse the Saudi Land for Peace proposal, which would have given Israel a permanent peace, including full normalization of relations with all its Arab neighbors, including the Palestinians. Sharon's response to this historic offer was to invade Jenin, Nablus, and the rest of the West Bank, during which time severe breaches of the Geneva Conventions were committed, amounting to war crimes, according to Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and B'Tselem. Until Israel gives back all the land that is not theirs, the conflict will never end. So the ultimate responsibility does lie with Israel to bring a just solution to the table. And parenthetically here, Barak's generous offer, this would be Prime Minister Ehud Barak's, quote, "generous offer at Camp David was woefully short of a just solution." See, from Jew to Jew, why we should oppose the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. For an in-depth discussion of this question, it is available online at jewishvoiceforpeace.org or by writing Jewish Voice for Peace, 1611 Telegraph Avenue, Suite 500, Oakland, California, 94612. And somewhere in there is a close parenthesis. First justice, then peace. It cannot happen the other way around. As you can see, if you put yourself in Palestinian shoes for just a minute. And this is why our vigil signs, quote, "blame Israel." They and they alone hold the key to a just and peaceful solution. Conclusion. Instead of blaming the messenger, I would request that concerned people work to change the reality. Just as it is not anti-American to oppose Bush's indefensible military adventures, neither is it anti-Israel to oppose the policies of state terrorism practiced by Sharon's government. In my opinion, author Chuck Scheer's opinion here, Ariel Sharon's actions in the past 3 years are well on the way to ruining the high moral standing of our people, developed over thousands of years. Referring, of course, to the Jewish people. Continuing. And he also bears the lion's share of responsibility for the upswing in anti-Semitic incidents worldwide, as people become enraged at Israel's tactics. Sticking your head in the sand and pretending that the world will not notice what Sharon is doing is just not a realistic option. By trying to change Israel's policies, I believe we are in fact fighting the root cause of increased anti-Semitism. I'll read it again. By trying to change Israel's policies, I believe we are in fact fighting the root cause of increased anti-Semitism. So are protests, quote, expressions of hatred of Israel? I don't believe so. Hate the sin but not the sinner is closer to our feelings. Indeed, I believe that our efforts to bring U.S. and Jewish public opinion to bear against the illegal Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza offers the only real path to peace and security for Israelis. Anything else is just a prescription for endless bloodshed. As Jimmy Carter wrote in the Washington Post, it is unlikely that real progress can be made as long as Israel insists on its settlement policy illegal under international laws, end quote. The day that the international community convinces Israel to live up to its obligations under the Geneva Conventions and remove their illegal settlements and illegal military occupation from Palestinian territory is the day that peace will become possible. And one more time, I'll read something again, that last sentence, according to Chuck Scheer here. The day that the international community convinces Israel to live up to its obligations under the Geneva Conventions and remove their illegal settlements and illegal military occupation from Palestinian territory is the day that peace will become possible. Chuck Scheer is a musician, business person, and longtime political and environmental activist in Petaluma, California. Petaluma is north of San Francisco a ways, probably in Marin County. He is the founder of the Petaluma Progressives and the author of JVP's most widely distributed pamphlet entitled From Jew to Jew, Why We Should Oppose the Occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. And again, that was the case 10 years ago when this anthology of Jewish-authored edited articles came out. It's called Reframing Anti-Semitism, Alternative Jewish Perspectives. So, I'll say it again. We're pretty much to the end of the program here. If you want to hear this show and previous readings of the anthology, as well as most or all of the successfully recorded and archived chapters from the two books that I mentioned earlier, read on this Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines, go to radioforall.net, and that's the number 4, R-A-D-I-O, character 4, A-L-L.N-E-T, radioforall.net, and type in Mideast Migraines to get those copies of all that stuff. You may also go to Santa Cruz Indy Bay, I-N-D-Y-B-A-Y, Santa Cruz Indy Bay. Click on the word Palestine wherever you see it. Also check the page-long green column on the right margin of their main website page for the most recent installations of the recordings of my readings. So, all told, that's 3 books, albeit the third one, a much, much shorter paperback anthology of 8 articles. I wanted to say, ooh, that's the wrong article. Ugh. When Mr. Scheer says, let's see here, Palestinian suicide bombings are also an utterly reprehensible tactic, and hundreds of innocent Israelis have been needlessly killed by the current fighting. It is even possible that there would already be a just peace in place if the Palestinians had been able to mount a sustained, nonviolent response to the Israeli occupation. The fact that they didn't is a real tragedy for both peoples. Just to reemphasize, Mr. Scheer is by no means putting the blame on Palestinians by admonishing their inability to mount a sustained nonviolent response to the Israeli occupation. There are many reasons why the many existing nonviolence rallies and protests and actions by the Palestinians are underplayed, if mentioned at all, in Western media and U.S. media. The political and media line in this country continues to maintain the myth, the image, that Israel is the victim surrounded by nothing but enemies, and this is really bizarre, surrounded by native Palestinians of Palestine and Israel, even though they are under either political or military or economic oppression one way or the other. The Israelis could only be surrounded by Palestinian Arabs, if you think of it in the sense that the presence of Palestinians in both countries is pervasive, and so they are quote-unquote everywhere. So Mr. Scherer is not blaming the Palestinians for somehow relenting and holding back and not oppressing Israelis, quote-unquote. It's a wild world, folks, and, you know, in the event that I had finished this book much earlier this afternoon, and it's just as well that I read the entire the first half of Article 7 again, and then all the rest of that in 8. I had some things lined up also pertaining to anti-Semitism. I will tell you that next Saturday, again, the Saturday Mideast Migraines installation on Free Radio Santa Cruz is dedicated to the readings of important current or more or less recent publications, books, and other major articles. What I want to do next Saturday, now that this book is finished and behind us now, with, of course, the archives available for your listening pleasure of it. Again, I want to begin reading about the nature and the history of Zionism, finding out what that was really about, what Theodor Herzl and his colleagues were thinking and talking about in the 1890s when they had their Congress in Europe, in Switzerland, which pretty much served as the formal founding of the Zionist philosophy. I'm going to get into that in more detail, and I will strive to come up with the most honest and pertinent and balanced sources for analyses of Zionism and its foundation and implementation, or at least the early part of its foundation. Okay, let's throw something up here to close out the program with. I will talk to you again next Saturday, inshallah, God willing, as some would say and believe. Next Saturday at 11 a.m., don't forget to turn your clocks. Let me see, fall back in the fall. Spring forward, fall back. You turn your clocks back 1 hour right at 2 a.m. You got to be up and awake at 2 a.m. Otherwise, it doesn't work. Well, anyway, by 2 a.m. Sunday morning, make sure you've gained an hour. You're gaining an hour of sleep, folks, or perhaps an hour of being awake. Turn your clock back by 1 hour tonight before you go beddy-bye. As we are leaving daylight savings time and going into standard time, at any rate, that does not change the start time for either of my programs. In fact, it does not, to the best of my understanding, change the start time of any of our Free Radio Santa Cruz programs. I will be with you again next Saturday at 11 a.m. for the discussion of the origins of Zionism. And, of course, I will talk at you on Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to donate. And don't forget to vote, folks. Tuesday, for the next 3 days, I'm going to be exerting my efforts and mental capacity to not only to filling out my ballot responsibly, but I'll be at the polls directing activities on the UC campus at that polling place. So I need to put all my energy into preparing for that, and then I can concentrate on the work, which I have already begun, by the way, on the analysis of the origins of Zionism. Take care and thank you.
going on the planes now, you always have this strange thing that comes out. This sweet little southern stewardess usually comes out and goes, "Ladies and gentlemen, before we board Flight 5, we're just going to do a few random bag checks. These are totally random. I'm just going to read off a few names. Hassan bin Singh. Hakim bin Laid.